The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Monday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in today. We got a great show with one of our most frequent best friends and most interesting guests, Dr. Eric Seedhouse. More about that in just a minute. Today is a full-length program. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring, and we'll get you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. You can also post a comment on our blog, and as soon as you hit the send button, I'll get a copy of it. And you can do that by going to our website, thespaceshow.com. All the way to the far right is the upcoming show menu. And then click on the first show. That is today's program with Dr. Seedhouse. And all the way at the bottom is where you post a blog comment, and go ahead and do that, whatever your comment or question is. And as soon as you hit the send button, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up on air. Our preferred way, of course, is the telephone, toll-free 1-866-687-7223, backed up by email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do visit our website while you're there, thespaceshow.com. Let me bring a couple of things to your attention. We do have our current website newsletter posted, and it's center right. You'll see it. And it has details for all of the week's programming. Plus, if you scroll down a bit, you will see all of the shows we have identified so far between now and the end of the year. And we're still booking in November and December. If you have a guest that you would like to recommend for us, please do so. There is still time. Send it to me via email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. On the upper left menu, remember there is Listen Live, and this tells you how to listen to live shows, archived programs on our website, those are compressed MP3s, and podcasts on our various podcast servers, including Alexa with Amazon and through the TuneIn app. It is embedded on that website page of ours. In addition, we're in the holidays period almost, right? People are going to be starting to think about gift giving and things like that. Well, visit our Space Show store. It is in the upper left under support. And you may find some items there for your favorite Space Show guests, the stocking stuffer, something of that nature. If you have suggestions for the store or something you think that we should offer to other listeners, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. For me, the most important part of the website is supporting the Space Show. So remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we're listener-supported, which means we're here because many of you do financially contribute to the Space Show. So as a 501c3, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. If you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction, as we're a public benefit corporation in California. Our parent, which is the 501c3, is one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. Do check it out. We're going to be announcing new advisory board information. Hopefully, I'll have it up and running by the time of open lines this coming Sunday. If not, I'll be able to talk about it on open lines this Sunday. Again, if you like our shows, you like our guests, you like interacting with them, do support us. and help us continue the space show. And your support is very vital to us. So again, information, just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We have two Amazon programs for supporting nonprofits. They're on the big Amazon button on our homepage. And then if you have any questions about contributing through PayPal or sending a check to the Space Show, email me again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. All of that information is on our homepage. But again, you may want to contact me with a specific question or two, and I'm happy to answer those for you. In addition to the individual support, we do have sponsors, and we're opening up for sponsors for 2019. And we only do a limited number of them because on following shows, we read a sponsor message, and that's about 60 seconds for each sponsor message, and they do eat into our guest talk time. So we limit those sponsor messages. But sponsors do get a banner ad running across the homepage. You can change that banner ad as often as you like. And as I said, on full-length shows, as is today, we read a short sponsor message. So, for example, for today, for the first segment, Northrop Grumman is a sponsor, and they are a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions to government and commercial customers worldwide. Their capabilities and technologies go from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. And we really appreciate the Northrop Grumman support. In addition, we also talk about space settlement. So the Space Development Network is a sponsor. And they are an online organization allowing you as a space advocate to join together with others to advance the plan for space development, which is space settlement. They're looking for people with a wide variety of interest and skills. It's a free network to join. And their website, as is on their banner ad, spacedevelopment.org. So do check it out. The National Space Society is a sponsor. They have ISDC around every Memorial Day in May, which is a great conference. Many of you do attend, and many of you do speak and participate at it. And then they also have other events during the year. They create white papers. They do a lot of other studies. For example, space settlement is a big topic for the National Space Society. Their website is space.nss.org. So I urge you to check them out as well. They're a great organization. And finally, for the first segment, the Space Foundation. So not only do they have their annual Bible of the economic development, progress, and growth of the space industry, both government and commercial, on their website, the Space Report. You can check it out. They're coming up with their absolutely new symposium, which is going to be, again, in April at the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs. So you can start checking that out on their web page. And I will, at the next Space Show program, start reading their actual messages for the new symposium. It's not too early to make a reservation, especially if you're planning to be at the Broadmoor, because it fills up really fast. It's an incredible place, and it is the center of unbelievable action at the Space Symposium. So for today, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, Eric Seithaus is back with us. And Dr. Seithaus doesn't need a space show introduction. He's been a very frequent guest, and we're really happy about that. But he is a Norwegian-Canadian suborbital astronaut. He's also an assistant professor in commercial space operations at Emory-Riddle Aeronautical University at the Daytona Beach campus. He is the most prolific author of all of the great authors we have on the space show. And he has a new book that is out on the market by Springer, and you can read it, and you should read it, Space, Radiation, and Astronauts. And that's what we're going to talk to him about today. His full bio is on our website. I urge you to check it out when you go to our website. But we'd rather talk with Eric than read about him. So welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
Well, thanks, David, and thanks for having me back.
Always a pleasure, always a pleasure. Why a book on radiation and astronauts? What motivated you to do this one?
First, it's an International Space University textbook, so this supports the program, the undergraduate program. I've written a couple of textbooks for the ISU, one on spaceports, and then another one on, what was it the one called? I've forgotten now. Got it there somewhere. Spaceports, and then the other one was vision impairment. That's right, the vision problems that astronauts have in space. And so the senior editor at Springer asked me if I'd like to write this book, and it's a topic that's close to my specialty, which is space life sciences, and it's also a problem that's overlooked by a lot of these announcements of going to Mars and going into deep space, because they sort of bypass the details, and this is part of the details. It's the keeping the astronauts alive part, which is pretty important. And the very best subject matter experts, such as Francis Cusinotta, for example, he is probably probably the world's leading expert when it comes to the effects of space radiation on astronauts. In his most conservative estimate, he reckons that a trip to Mars would cut 15 to 25 years off the life of an astronaut. That's not to say that astronauts wouldn't still line up outside the door of the astronaut office to volunteer for such a mission, but still, NASA has a duty to keep the astronauts safe and relatively healthy.
What's his name again? Say his name again.
It's Francis Cusinotta.
He's been on the show. So here's the problem. First of all, he gets dismissed by a lot of space astronauts. He's been on the show two or three times, and people dismiss him because obviously they don't like the message. But if you listen to a lot of space advocates, some who are extremely well-informed, and if you ask them, they'll tell you just how well-informed they are, this is a solved problem. We know how to shield. We know how to protect. We've got materials, including water. We know how many inches or feet of regolith or this or that or that. And the instruments on the way to Mars on different missions show that this is not a big deal. Bob Zubrin, of course, is a big advocate of this approach, and many others have accepted that approach. So they totally dismiss Frank, and they'd probably disagree with what you're saying and say it is a managed problem. It's not a cured problem, but it is a managed problem where it's not going to be a big deal as long as you manage it. And I'm sure you've heard all this too, Eric.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason I wrote the book. I mean, this is something that we know an awful lot about. I mean, anybody who's known, who's been through cancer or who knows anybody who's been through cancer knows something about radiotherapy. We know an awful lot about the effects of radiation on the human physiology, and it's all pretty bad news. And now we extrapolate that out to spending a long time in deep space, and it gets even worse. I mean, we have a very good idea of just how much radiation there is out there, because when they sent the Curiosity rover to Mars, they put a radiation assessment detector on it and to characterize the deep space environment. And so they have an idea of how much radiation is there. And it's probably a good idea to put this in perspective. So for people who aren't familiar with, the difference between radiation here on Earth and radiation in low Earth orbit and then radiation in deep space, those are the three comparative metrics there. So, for example, here on Earth, your annual background radiation exposure is about two.
What the hell? How do we get a football game on the show?
I don't know what happened there.
I don't know either, because we're closed-circuit streaming. That's weird.
That is bizarre. I'll start that again. So a good comparative metric is to compare the radiation exposure here on Earth to radiation exposure in low Earth orbit and then deep space. And when we measure radiation exposure when it's applied to humans, we tend to use sieverts. And here on Earth, in 1 year, you'd be exposed to 2/1000ths of a sievert, so 2 millisieverts. Now, if you spend 6 months on low Earth orbit as an astronaut, you will be exposed to 80 millisieverts. So that's 80 times the annual dose. Because if you spend a year in orbit, you'd have 160 millisieverts. So that adds up. It's cumulative. So that's why there's a limit to the career of an astronaut based on radiation. And NASA tracks this using the longitudinal survey of astronaut health. And once you reach your radiation limit, that's it. You're grounded. You don't fly anymore. Now, on the way to Mars and back, so a typical mission to Mars, the 6 months out, however many months on the surface, and then 6 months back, you're talking about well over a sievert, so way over the dose. So basically, to put that in perspective, it's like getting 10 times your annual dose every single day of a Mars mission. And that exceeds the career lifetime limits for a NASA astronaut. And it equates to a reduction of about 15 to 25 years of your lifespan based on the increased risk of cancer for those astronauts.
Okay, so what about the fact that we can shield for it? So this is unshielded dosages. What happens if you protect the spaceship and the crew?
Well, that 80 millisieverts, that is what you get with the shielding. So there are parts of the space station that are more shielded than other parts because they take the brunt of the radiation. So they use polyethylene, for example. There are parts of the space station that are covered in polyethylene. There are some of the modules that are thicker than other modules, the skin of the modules, because they know that that part of the module is going to take on more of the radiation. So, yes, we can shield. There are shielding materials. Now, to give yourself the same shielding protection that you have here on Earth, you need a water wall that is 33 feet thick. Now, we know astronauts are risk takers, so they can take a little bit of a higher risk. But even so, even if you reduce that water wall by 50%, you're still looking at a water wall that is 15, 16 feet thick. And so that's you just can't do that with a spacecraft. So now you're talking at water walls. Like a storm shelter. So you have the skin of the module, and then inside the module, you can maybe install what's called a water wall. This is one of the latest life support subsystems that they're looking at. So it serves a dual function. First, you have the water, which you need anyway for life support, and second, that water, the water wall, provides a storm shelter in the case of a radiation event. But even so, we're talking about two different types of radiation. We're talking about the solar radiation, which we get here in the solar system, and then we're talking about galactic cosmic radiation. And galactic cosmic radiation represents about 1% of all the radiation during a deep space mission, but represents 99% of the damage. That's how damaging this galactic cosmic radiation is. And you really can't shield against this. These are heavy ions traveling at close to light speed, and you'd need an incredible amount of shielding to protect yourself from this. So Yes, we have shielding, but we don't really have shielding that can protect us from galactic cosmic rays.
What about just having astronauts that are older? Because one of the things we always hear is you can send older people because they're more resistant to radiation.
Well, not only that's absolutely right. And another reason you would send older astronauts is because NASA works on the increased risk of cancer over a lifetime. So basically the limit for an astronaut is a 3% increased risk of cancer over a lifetime. Now, if you have old astronauts, they have less life to live, so that increase can be reduced, if you understand what I'm saying, if you follow me there.
Uh-huh.
So that's one way to get around it. And yes, but up until very, very recently, they didn't think there was a gene for people who are radiation resistant or radiation susceptible, but now they think they may have found a gene that predicts whether somebody can absorb more radiation than others. And so that would be maybe a criteria by which you select astronauts. But still, you're looking at a huge amount of radiation increase beyond which astronauts in low Earth orbit have right now.
Could today, with today's technology, assuming we have a spacecraft capable of going to Mars, could we travel safely to and from Mars with humans?
Well, it depends on what the definition of safety is. I mean, like I say, that 15 to 25 reduction in lifespan is based on not just one or two research papers. This is based on hundreds and hundreds of peer-reviewed research papers based on a lot of information based on radiotherapy and also information from deep space. We've actually used animal modeling, for example. The information that we got back from the radiation assessment detector that was attached to Curiosity on the last Mars mission, what they did, they subjected rats to that radiation, obviously weight-adjusted, because obviously you don't give the same amount of radiation to a rat that you would as a human, because humans are bigger. So what they did, they took these rats, they had... First, they had them do a cognitive task, and that was simply to go through a maze. They started the stopwatch, had the rats go through the maze, stopped the stopwatch, and they took half the rats and subjected them to Mars-equivalent radiation. Then they compared the control group with the radiation-exposed group to see what the effects would be in the maze. And the rats that had been exposed to radiation had all sorts of problems. Some of them couldn't get their way through the maze. Some of them that managed to get their way through the maze took an awful lot longer. And so the scientists thought, okay, we better take a look at the brains of these rats to see what happened. and they did MRIs, which are basically slices of the brain, and they could see the similar signs to what is equivalent to early onset Alzheimer's, because they had cognitive deficiencies because the damage to the brain is caused by this these very very heavy ions, which are equivalent to the cosmic radiation. So it's a pretty serious business that we're talking about when we're talking about these galactic cosmic rays hitting astronauts.
So what do you say to these enthusiasts? You must meet them the same as I do all the time, and they're ready to go with Musk to Mars in 2 or 3 years or 4 years, whatever that timeline is, assuming that timeline turns into being real. We don't ever hear Musk talk about life support issues, so I don't know where he is on radiation mitigation or anything else. Maybe you know more about that than I do. But what is your response to the enthusiast who's ready to pick up and go?
Well, the thing is, Musk, SpaceX, and other government-owned corporations, so they have no duty to the taxpayer to ensure the safe or ensure the safety of their astronauts. All they need is a launch license and a reentry license, and they can do whatever the hell they want. And so they it's not like NASA. NASA is a government entity, and they have a duty to ensure the safety of the astronauts. So you'll have people lining up outside the door to go to Mars, no matter what the risk. There's always going to be people.
But they have a duty for full disclosure. So they have to disclose under the law what their risks are, which is you've been talking about for the last 30 minutes.
They do, but I'm not sure, like I said, this is a legal matter, I'm not sure if they're bound to the same extent that NASA is, since NASA is a government-sponsored agency. They have a duty for disclosure, but I'm not sure to what extent they're bound to protect the safety of the astronauts.
I think, because I've done a lot of shows on this, the informed consent is you have to provide all of the information. It's not designed to protect anybody. They are assumed to be able to make their own decision with the information you give them, and the information you give them has to be legitimate, fair, and objective and real. But they would be really hard-pressed to have a set of disclosures and a space capsule outfitted one way for private astronauts and another way that was much stricter and more secure for government astronauts. So can you imagine the litigation that would fly from someone being injured on the private sector when they're being flown to standards less than what the government's being flown for, even if they did inform consent on that? I think that'd be a hell of a problem to have two sets of standards there.
You're right, but I think that may well happen. It's like I say, it's a question for the lawyers, but I think that's probably how it's going to happen.
I can't see that, but you know, I guess I'd believe anything in today's world, but I think that would be such a dumb, stupid-ass corporate decision. I cannot believe they'd have a set of different standards for NASA and a different standard for you and me. I don't get it. I don't think they'd be that stupid. But look, Eric, there's a lot of stupid stuff in this world. So
that's right.
So who knows? But you're right. I mean, there'll be people who would go if the odds were far worse than what you're suggesting. I mean, I think there'd be no shortage of people wanting to sign up for the adventure.
Yeah, you look at all the websites and all the blogs on Mars, and the Mars Society, all these organizations, there's a sort of groundswell of support for this mission and has been for decades, and it's just getting more and more, I wouldn't say desperate, but I mean, Elon Musk, I mean, I've just started writing my second edition of SpaceX, which is my best-selling book, and the second chapter is pretty much a biography of Elon Musk. And I call him the Mars Messiah, because I think that's what these, the people who want to go to Mars, the manned Mars enthusiasts, that's how they see him now, because finally he's given them a viable route to Mars, probably the most viable one in decades, really, because forever it's always been a 30-year problem. It's always been 30 years away for NASA. Now all of a sudden you have SpaceX, which has sort of upset the apple cart and come along with this BFR and the ITS. And said we can do this not in 30 years, but in 5 or 6 or whatever. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But it is almost fanatical. You start reading some of these blogs, and it becomes almost fanatical.
I would think Dr. Zubrin would be the Mars Society, the Mars whatever you called it. I'm losing the word for a moment, because he also has been pushing for this, and he dismisses most of the conventional radiation wisdom and always talks about it being no more dangerous than smoking a pack of cigarettes a day or two or something of that nature.
No, you can't. Peer-reviewed journals are exactly that, peer-reviewed. I mean, they're reviewed by the scientists. They look very, very carefully at the science that's been conducted, the research that's been duplicated, and it's not just, you know, the isolated half dozen articles here or there. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of articles that all say the same thing, that this galactic cosmic radiation is bad. It's bad for you. It's going to cause lots and lots of bad problems. It's going to cause accelerated bone loss. It's going to cause cataracts. We know that from Apollo. 40% of the Apollo astronauts got cataracts within 5 years of coming back. That's radiation-induced cataracts. We know that from radiotherapy. All sorts of bad things are going to happen to you. And, we can dismiss it by making that comment about it being no more harmful than smoking a few cigarettes a day. But in reality, it's a hell of a lot worse.
Your first email of the day is Jerry in Orlando. And he says, I'm still at work, David. I'm using email. My question is, why, if we really want to go to Mars, don't we finally create nuclear propulsion so we can go much, much faster and reduce the risk just because we're cutting the travel time down?
Well, that is the solution. I teach this to my students. I say, look, there's one way you can get rid of a lot of these problems. You know, don't have to worry about as much about artificial gravity, bone demineralization, muscle atrophy, all these physiological life support problems. They don't go away, but they're diminished significantly by getting there quickly. And so we have one realizable technology, and I know some people don't agree with me on this, but Vasimir, that's been in the works for 40 years. It's solid. They have a Space Act agreement with NASA to fly a scale-down Vasimir on ISS in 2020 to do reboost operations. It's a scalable technology. Like your caller said, there is a requirement for nuclear power to actually generate the sufficient power on this engine. But like I say, it is scalable, and if they can scale it up to 200 megawatts, then you can get to Mars in 6 weeks and not 6 months. And if you can get to Mars in 6 weeks, then you don't have to worry about as much about the radiation and everything else.
Well, Eric, your challenges are starting. So here is an email from your first challenger, who is over in Sweden, which is actually not too far from Norway. So this is from Bjorn, or Bjorn. Dismissed totally. What medical data do you have for your claim? If you look at the Apollo astronauts and long-term space station crews, Earth's magnetic field doesn't protect much against high-energy galactic rays, does it? It might even accelerate them. What's your medical data? How would you collect it without human spaceflight in interplanetary space?
Well, I can direct you to a science article published in 1974, Light Flashes Observed by Astronauts from Apollo 11 through Apollo 17. This is published by Pinsky and Osborne, Bailey, Benson, and Thompson. And like I say, this is just one of many, many research papers. And Science is a very highly peer-reviewed journal. And they categorize, the instances of cataractogenesis, which is radiation-induced cataracts, on the Apollo astronauts. And what was the other part of the question, David?
He's asking for your medical data. He says he references astronauts and Apollo astronauts, and the Earth's magnetic field doesn't protect much against GCRs. It might even accelerate them. And again, he's repeating for your medical data. How would you collect the research data on human spaceflight if you didn't actually physically undergo human spaceflight in interplanetary space? So it's like it has to be on-the-job collection of data. It can't be laboratory gathered, is I think what he's trying to say.
Well, the only thing we can say is that we have guinea pigs up there right now, and they're called astronauts in low Earth orbit on the ISS. I mean, that was the main reason for the ISS in the first place, was to gather information on the effects of long-duration spaceflight on astronauts, and part of that is radiation. We have All the astronauts have personal dosimeters. A dosimeter is a way of measuring radiation. They carry those with them all the time. Also, each module has dosimeters. So the Space Radiation Assessment Group, which has its own console in Mission Control, has that information 24/7. It's streamed out to them all the time, so they know exactly how much radiation those astronauts are being exposed to, exactly how much radiation the modules are being exposed to. So that is real, actual data that we've been getting for the last 20 years now, because the ISS celebrates its 20th birthday next month. So we have a huge amount of information. Hundreds of astronauts have flown the International Space Station for months and months and months at a time, collecting all this radiation data. So that's the answer to that. In terms of the other medical data, then you go to spaceflight-relevant types of ionizing radiation. And there's literally thousands and thousands of peer-reviewed journal articles published in Advanced Space Research, published in Radiation Research Journal. I mean, there's actually a journal dedicated to radiation research that he can check in on, and there's literally hundreds, if not thousands, of research articles based on spaceflight-relevant types of ionizing radiation and their effect on anything from bone density to muscle to cancer therapy, bone loss, fracture risk, you name it. There's all sorts of radiobiological analyses of spaceflight-relevant radiation here on the ground. But like I say, the last 20 years, that's been our best lab, is the ISS for finding this out.
Bjorn, I don't think you probably have a copy yet of his book, but I do. I have an e-book copy of the book, and I have it pulled up on the computer right now. And Eric has 21 footnote, well-documented references to support what his research is in the book and his analysis and his conclusion. So, and they're footnoted. So number 7, you could find out what number 7 is in the literature of the book, for example. So, he does support his arguments and his conclusions. And if you want to go after his support, I would suggest you grab a copy of the book and you go through the references and see what he's saying and how it is cited, plus what he just said in response to your answer. And you might want to adjust your question, or maybe you'll be happy with your question. Maybe it won't be convincing, but there is research in back of his comments and conclusions. If you're asking him to give you a specific footnote or document, I think he came as close to that as he can do on radio just a few minutes ago with some of the journals that he mentioned and things like that. But the subject is out there, and the Medical Doctors Association for Space and all of these different groups have lots of peer-reviewed MD as well as on the PhD side research on this subject. And there's lots of extrapolated cancer data. So, and I used to have a lot of these people from Brookhaven on the show. They're now doing cancer, back to cancer work at various hospitals around the country.
Yeah, and that's where that rat research was conducted, was Brookhaven National.
Well, yeah, I had what's his name on who did the cognitive studies on rats from UC Irvine, and he was totally dismissed and ridiculed, and he was on the show twice, and his research, his study. So Zubrin's arguments against his work on the cognitive studies was that they gave the rats such huge doses of radiation that there's nothing relevant for humans, and so therefore it doesn't count.
No, it was it's stated specifically in that article that it was weight adjusted.
I understand that.
This book we're talking about now is not a popular science book. This is not me making random statements. It is a textbook, and because it's a textbook, every statement I make has to be bulletproofed with a research article, and I've done that. So, for example, if you go to chapter 2, there are 31 references there that bulletproof every statement made in that chapter, just on that chapter alone. And you go to chapter by chapter by chapter, and you'll see there's every single chapter is bulletproofed by 30, 40 references to peer-reviewed journals that support the statements made in every chapter. So, like I said, I just want to emphasize that this is not a popular science book we're talking about. This is a peer-reviewed textbook.
Well, so I would urge you, Bjorn, to check out some of his references in the books and some of the journals that he's talking about. You know how to reach Eric, or you can get through him to him through the blog, and if you actually find critical fault in the references or in the research or peer-reviewed articles, point it out. That's what I could say. I mean, you're not supplying any medical information for your critique. So I kind of think it goes both ways. If you want to attack the references, and you certainly can, attack it with evidence. And that would be welcome on our blog.
And again, these are not just, these are some high-impact research journals. So for those of you who know about journals, they not all have the same impact. They actually are graded on, based on impact factor. So there's an impact factor assigned to them. So there's the higher the number, the greater the impact factor. So some of these journals are cancer research. Cancer research is a pretty high impact factor when it comes to journals, for obvious reasons. Radiation research, that's another big one. Let's see, Journal of Radiation Research, Oncologist. These are the sort of journals I'm generally using to look for information to actually support the statements made in the book. As anybody knows, cancer is one of the biggest research areas in the world, and not surprisingly, there are literally thousands and thousands of studies out there. And to make your way into a prestigious journal such as Cancer Research, you have to be pretty damn good at what you do.
Well, again, I invite Bjorn or anybody to critically challenge and question Eric and his work, or any of our other guests for that matter. But you got to do it with fact too. So you can't just do it with your hunches or your intuition. You got to, you know, as they say, in God we trust, everything else bring numbers. So Eric's bringing numbers to the discussion. And if you want to challenge that analysis, or the analysis of Dr. Cucinotta or the other gentleman from UC Irvine, I apologize, I can't remember his name right now. Bring numbers, you know, bring data that refutes it. I'm all for it, and I support putting it up on the blog and letting light shine on all of it. How do you see going to Mars? Because that seems to be, you know, the big interest of people. How is it going to play out? Is radiation, you know, when I ask these people that are on the show, including like Cucinotta and others, is this a showstopper? Nobody says there's any showstoppers. They all say there are challenges. So, okay, so there's no showstoppers, including radiation. There are only challenges, but do they really sort of secretly mean that it's a showstopper, but they don't want to have the guts to say it's a showstopper? Is that what's going on here?
No, I think there's nobody's going to say there's a single showstopper. It's the cumulative effect. So we know from 20 years on space station now that we have, you know, 6 months on space station, you're going to lose about 20 to 25% of your muscle mass total. That's your cardiac muscle, that's the skeletal muscle, everything, organ tissue, everything. You're going to lose about 20 to 25% of that in 6 months. Now, we all know the Mars mission is going to be a lot longer than that. But in terms of, in addition to muscle, you're losing 1 to 1.2% of your bone mass every single month, and there's no, and that just keeps on losing bone mass.
But you get it, but you get some of it back, and some people have better recovery rates than others, correct?
And that's it, and that's a black hole. So, for example, what's his name? The German astronaut, European Space Agency astronaut, I'm trying to remember his name now.
I know who you're talking about, but I can't think of it either.
1995.
Right.
Reiter, Thomas Reiter. In 1995, he flew a 6 month mission on Mir. And then 10 years later, he had still not recovered his bone mass that he had lost. So, yes, there are some people who recover bone mass quickly. There are other people who do not recover bone mass quickly. There are some people's bone whose architecture is affected more than others. Some people's architecture is preserved better than others. Some people's bone density is preserved better. Some people lose bone density quicker. But we're talking about such small end numbers because there's less than 600 people who've ever flown in space ever. And so we just really don't know. We can't see a pattern evolving in terms of who has good bone density, who has less bone density. But there are markers for that. There are genetic markers, and NASA actually used phenotyping for the first time last year in terms of maybe considering, you know, genetic screening for astronauts to maybe basically select those who would lose less bone and also those who are more radiation resistant as crew. So it's not, there's not one single you know, mission killer. It's accumulation of all the bad things that happen to you in a flight, and that over such a long period of time, you know, two and a half years, that combined could be a mission killer. Okay, it depends on the perception of risk.
Bjorn, I hope I get your name right. You told me to go ahead and say Bjorn because it's easier for me, but I'm trying to be more international here. So Bjorn, I think, is how you actually pronounce your name. I didn't ask about references to guys with similar theories. I'm not the guy trying to sell a book. I ask about real data from radiation damages from human spaceflight. Do the 500-plus astronauts suffer more radiation damage than comparable groups?
Yes, they do, because they're exposed to more radiation than we are here on Earth. And so that information is stored in a repository called the Longitudinal Survey of Astronaut Health. I mean, that's private. Don't forget that astronauts are the pinnacle of health. So it's very difficult to compare the astronaut group with the people here on Earth, because the people are here on Earth, they wouldn't pass the astronaut medical. Most people wouldn't. Even those who get the final 30 or 40 of selection, half of those are discounted because the medical is so very, very, very stringent. And so they represent the 1,000th of 1% of the very, very, very healthiest people on the planet. And so when you factor that component into the equation, it's a little bit difficult to actually make comparative metrics with the average person here on Earth. But they have the reason there's been no increased risk of cancer in the astronaut population is because NASA has been very conservative. It has set its metric as a 3% increased risk of cancer over a lifetime. That's the career limit. If you exceed that, then you're grounded. And so that is a very conservative metric. And they, like I say, they have a duty for care of their astronauts. So to get back to answering the question in a roundabout way, the only damage we've seen is those astronauts that have gone into deep space, which are the Apollo astronauts, and we've seen an increase in cataracts. And 40% of the Apollo astronauts within 5 years got cataracts, and that was assumed to be radiation-induced cataracts, which is called cataractogenesis. And that's a similar something that we see in cancer patients as well, because they have an increased risk of cataracts.
What do we see with European astronauts, Russian astronauts, Chinese taikonauts? Do we have any data or research on them and their radiation exposure and changes or issues?
We have data. The most recent data we have in comparative metrics is Scott Kelly and Mark Kelly's twins experiment. And so what they're seeing, this is only about a year after coming back from Earth, they saw a 7% change in the DNA structure between Scott Kelly and Mark Kelly, which is pretty impressive. Well, I won't say impressive, but pretty striking. And they think some of those changes may, because they haven't crunched all the data yet, and this will take a few years. They think some of those changes in the DNA structure may have been caused by radiation, because what happens when radiation strikes the DNA structure, it creates what are called single strand and double strand breaks. You have the DNA helix, and what happens, obviously the body goes straight in to repair those. The body has fantastic repair mechanisms, but it can only do repairs so well so many times. So every time it does a repair, it becomes less and less effective. And after a while, the repair mechanism is not as effective as it was the first time the damage was done. And that ultimately can affect DNA structure.
What about with Russians and Chinese or even European astronauts? Or they're probably closer to the NASA level. But what can you compare, say, American astronauts with Russian or Chinese?
Well, we can't, because we're looking at long-term effects. In low Earth orbit, we're protected from the worst of the deep space radiation. So we have long-duration astronauts who are exposed to a lot more radiation than we are here on Earth. But it takes time to see those long-term effects. And, of course, mostly we have to wait another maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years to see the effects of that. What is different in the deep space radiation environment is that you have a lot more of this more damaging radiation, which is galactic cosmic radiation. And when you're exposed to that amount, that much more increase in galactic cosmic radiation, you're going to see more near-term effects as opposed to more long-term effects.
If I were Bjorn, I'd be sending in an email right now saying, I believe you're making very aggressive decisions or conclusions that are not yet totally supported by the evidence, though the evidence may be hard to get and may be limited. So would I be wrong in saying that you're making conclusions based on limitations? Were I Bijan?
I'm not making any conclusions. Like I say, the statements that I make are backed up by radiation. So what they can do here on Earth is to look at radiotherapy in humans, which we've had decades of experience with. Literally millions of people have gone through radiation therapy. We've also looked at modeling, which they can do. They can model galactic cosmic radiation here and actually look at cognitive impairment by looking at what they call plaque accumulations in mice. That's basically damage to the brain. And that's been done. And so that's what we're reduced to. We're basically reduced to looking at the effects of radiotherapy on humans who have cancer and modeling. That's the best we can do because we've only ever sent a dozen astronauts into deep space, and they only represent a very small group of what is already a very, very small group.
So it seemed to me for research bases, which, you know, I'm sure would not fly with people who do the protocols on research, you'd want to get as many people into long-term space flight as possible for research guinea pigs to collect data, but I understand that's not practical either economically, and you'd probably never get through a review board to do that. But that would really serve the experimentation role really well, because it looks like it can't be simulated. It's got to be on-the-job research, right?
Yeah, and that's where the Deep Space Gateway comes in, because the Deep Space Gateway, the way it's planned now, is that they spend a fair amount of time at the Deep Space Gateway, maybe make excursions onto the lunar surface, and basically stay in deep space for several months, which is a lot longer than the Apollo flights. I mean, the first Apollo flight was only 8 days.
Right.
The longest Apollo flight was only less than 2 weeks. That was Apollo 17. So the amount of time we have, even the cumulative time we have in space, would be increased significantly by these missions that are planned for the Deep Space Gateway. So that is going to result in a lot more radiation data that we don't have.
Julie is in Seattle, and she says, is there any indication that gender or race makes any difference in how radiation affects the body?
Yeah, so the way they measure radiation effects on the body is by parts of the body. So there are certain parts of the body that are more susceptible to radiation than other parts of the body. So, for example, the brain, your reproductive organs, and some of your organs are more susceptible to radiation damage or radiation exposure than other parts of the body, say, for example, your muscles. And so you have to protect those susceptible parts more than the other parts, and that's led to actually some interesting clothing being developed by the European Space Agency. It's basically like a shield, almost like a bulletproof vest. I guess you'd call it the equivalent to a bulletproof vest, but instead of protecting yourself against bullets, you're protecting yourself from radiation. And it's you wear this vest, and it covers your organs, obviously, and your reproductive organs, and also you have a skull cap to protect against the brain. And in terms of the difference between male and female, males tend to be more susceptible to radiation than males. Having said that, the outright record holder for long-duration spaceflight is Peggy Whitson. She has the longest cumulative spaceflight of any NASA astronaut, and she's female, obviously. And that just brings us back to that point of people. Brings us back to the point where we were talking about some people being more susceptible than others. By all rights, Peggy Whitson should not have the long duration record because she's female, but she's an exception. She seems to be more radiation resistant than most other females, because generally most female astronauts have lower career expectancies because they just cannot they get close to their career limit sooner than males.
Can you get research information on people, or do privacy and HIPAA laws prevent that?
Well, no, it's the longitudinal survey of astronaut health. That's private information. But you can see, you can do your own research really on this. You can just look at the number of female astronauts that have flown and look at the cumulative lengths of all their missions, and then compare that with males. And it's always a lot less, except for Peggy Whitson.
Interesting. When you said you use this book as a textbook, What do students do with the information? How do they process it? Does this sort of depress them about their human spaceflight possibilities, getting to Mars on a BFR or something like that, or are they more grounded because they're in a graduate school program, you know, looking for facts to begin with?
Well, no, it's not all doom and gloom. I mean, there's a whole chapter there on shielding, which is talks about electrical shielding and magnetic shielding and polyethylene and all the rest of it. Then there's a whole chapter on pharmacological countermeasures, basically how you can use radio protectors in the case of, treating acute radiation sickness. The genetic profile and manipulation of omics, which is the new fad in medicine. It's personalized medicine. So all sorts of ways of not getting around it, but sort of mitigating the risk. So, no, I just want to emphasize it's not all doom and gloom, but it's based on hard fact. This is not popular science. This is not, spinning something in any which way or any direction. It's just basically hard fact, like I say, bulletproof with hundreds of references.
We're going to take a break. We're more than halfway, but I've got a couple of emails that I'll do with you when we get back from the break. And they're talking about the interest in space farming and what radiation might do to food and space farming. So I'll ask you about that when we come back from the break.
All right.
So everybody sit tight. We'll be back with Dr. Seedhouse with more of your questions. Calls are welcome. I know many of you listen to the show while you're at work on Monday, but the toll-free number is available if you want to use it, 1-866-687-7223. We answer the phone during the break. So back in three.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of the Space Show. We do have our sponsors that we want to thank. The Integrated Space Plan, and this is the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming spacefaring. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan.com. You can buy your own copy of the Space Plan, and it's suitable for framing. It's very impressive. All of this can be found and more at their website, thespaceplan.com. AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is our sponsor, and they have five forums, which are actually conferences per year: SciTech, Defense, Aviation, Propulsion and Energy, and Space, which they just recently concluded in Orlando. They have great programming, incredible networking, lots of people to meet and to talk to about all sorts of different topics, multiple tracks, just about every subject, including new space. You can get a lot more information at their website. You can join it. You do not have to be an engineer to join it. I'm not an engineer. Their website is aiaa.org. And then Celestis is our sponsor. And remember, they are still the only proven provider of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. They have multiple flights coming up. So you can do suborbital flights of your loved one's DNA and or ashes. You know, it's basically for a little bit of the cremated ashes of a loved one, but DNA will suffice. You can mix it with your own DNA as well. But there's suborbital out of New Mexico. There's orbital out of the Cape. There's orbital out of Vandenberg. And there will soon be another flight. They've already had one flight. There will soon be another lunar service mission going on the Electron rocket out of New Zealand. And I don't have a final date for that. It has been delayed a little bit as they continue to test flight the rocket. If you're interested in a Celestis option for a loved one or maybe for yourself, contact them at Celestis.com. And remember, I am their customer. I have flown my mom's ashes and my dog's ashes on multiple flights, suborbital and orbital, and they are scheduled to go to the moon on the next lunar flight. Great company, everybody. Tell them you heard about Celestis on the space show. So, Eric, going back to where we left off when we ended the first segment, I'll ask one of these emails because there's three of them that are similar. So Kelly's in Tucson, and Kelly says there's been lots of talk. I've even seen papers about agriculture taking food to Mars, even space farming, whatever space farming may look like. What role will radiation play on our food stocks, whether we're growing it in space, on the moon, on Mars, in some kind of a greenhouse, or just taking it in stores?
So first of all, we're not very advanced when it comes to growing plants in space. So the first time that actually happened was in August 2015 when Scott Kelly ate a slice of lettuce, or a blade of lettuce, romaine lettuce, I think it was. And the problem is something called gravitropism. So gravitropism is something that we have here on Earth. It's basically plants knowing what to do here on Earth in 1G, and so they know how far to put roots down, and because of that, they grow healthy root systems and have a good yield. But in space, we don't have any gravitropism. There's an absence of gravity, and so plants don't have good yields. They don't put their root systems down very well. And so, first of all, we're not growing a lot of food in space. We're growing very, very little. Now, when you start including radiation, because don't forget all the few plants that have been grown in low Earth orbit. Now, when we start going into deep space, we start encountering more radiation. And the effect or the extent to which radiation will affect plants will depend on the amount of radiation. So a little bit of radiation, it's not going to do that much damage, but the amount of radiation we talk about in deep space, then we're talking about similar effects that we have on humans. So we have chromosomal aberrations, basically changes in the DNA structure. You can see growth reduction, so yield, and that's really important because we already have very low yields in the few plants that we've grown in space. Reproductive effects, just like sterility, things like that. And also mortality. So you're basically going to get more plants dying the more radiation exposure there is. Having said that, we do have some studies that have been conducted on plants that have been grown in high radiation areas. So if you remember Chernobyl back in, was it 86?
Right.
That was a big accident. And there was, from that accident, we discovered which plants are more resilient than others. And apparently one of the most resilient plants are flax plants. Now, I don't know what sort of meals you can make out of flax. But apparently these guys are it's very, very rugged, and they can do very, very well. It's a good source of plant fiber and oil, but it's doesn't really make much in terms of a meal. But from that accident, they actually found some of these plants that are more radiation resistant than others. So that would be a consideration, obviously. You do want to take plants that grow well in the absence of gravity. You'd also want to take plants that grow well in a high radiation environment. The only downside to that would be perhaps these plants would not make the best diet.
does the radiation change the quality of nutrition, the taste? Does it make it toxic to eat? I mean, you know, there's, I don't know that if it's the same thing, but there's all these movements around to not allow or to stop or telling you not to eat radiated food, which they do for obviously a different reason. I don't know whether their arguments have any merit or not. And I don't know if it's comparable to what you're talking about, but there seems to be some opposition toward radiation and food in the same sentence.
As far as I know, that would only become a problem if you're talking about very, very high levels of radiation. And at that point, then you're looking at mutations in the plant structure. And obviously, that wouldn't be a good thing to eat. We're talking about levels higher than we'd expect, even in a deep space transit to Mars.
Joe is in Denver, and he said years ago, when we used to hear frequently from Mars One, they had all sorts of lavish plans to grow food, to oxygenate the food, to have certain kinds of greenhouses. Did any of that make sense? Eric, I believe you studied and wrote a book on Mars One. I know, David, you had the MIT group that was very critical of all of this on your show multiple times. Did the Mars One strategy for growing food on Mars make any sense? Did we learn anything from it?
No, that's always been the aim, is to close the loop on the life support system. So right now, if we were to go to Mars, it would be taking a lot of U-Haul trucks behind us with consumables and spare parts, because the life support system is it's maintenance intensive, let's put it that way. And also, we don't produce all our consumables. So for example, the oxygen generating assembly on the ISS only produces about half of the oxygen required. Only recycles so much of the water. For example, the urine processing assembly operates at 73-74% efficiency, which means we start to bring up water from Earth. And one way of closing the loop, so basically creating what is a partially closed life support system that we have now to almost a fully closed life support system, is to create what's called a bioregenerative life support system. And one way we do that is to increase the amount of plants that are being grown on station. And that's why there's so many plant experiments on station right now, because they produce oxygen. That's a big thing. That really helps with the oxygen production. Also, it's a psychological boost for the crew. Also, gets rid of carbon dioxide. And also reduces the mass penalty of having to bring food from Earth to ISS. So the more food you can grow, the less mass penalty there is. So, yeah, it's a great idea. And there's a few places in the world that actually are developing closed life support systems. So I was there at one of these places just a few weeks ago in Barcelona, the University of Barcelona. There's a place called MELISSA. It's a European Space Agency life support system research project that has been going for 25 years. And their aim is to create a closed life support system. And they have. And you walk from lab to lab to lab, and you walk past all this incredible equipment, and all this equipment supports one person, one astronaut. And this is the product of the best life support scientists in the world working for 25 years to create a life support system that will support one person, and it occupies lab after lab after lab. So we have a long way to go there, but a key component of MELISSA is growing plants, and they've been very successful with that. They've done a very, very, very good job. And like I say, every year they get closer and closer to obviously scaling this life support system down. And as I said before, a key component of that is growing plants.
Wouldn't be very practical for space yet, then, given your description of it.
No, and like I say, this is another thing where people sort of brush over the details in terms of life support. They say, well, we can use artificial gravity. Well, we can't, because we cancelled the centrifuge accommodations module 15 years ago and it hasn't been used. We can grow plants. I mean, these are just bold statements that people just soak up and think, oh, yeah, problem solved. But it isn't. We're a long, long, long way from having even a partially closed, well, we have a partially closed system, but we are a long way from having a system that is closed enough to enable a Mars mission.
Ben in Chicago sent in an email, and he said, given the interest in space settlement, This seems to imply at some point during the lifespan of the settlement that there are going to be children, or that there are going to be babies born, or that it's going to be like a real settlement or a real village, and evolve with schools and other things. So what do we know about the potential risk of radiation only, not all the other risk, on pregnancy, fetal growth, raising children in that environment, although the low gravity environment might play a bigger part than radiation? Is any of this feasible, or is a space settlement village going to be nothing more than a place where adults live out the rest of their life?
Well, we know some of the effects of radiation on reproduction, because we know about Chernobyl, and we know about Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and that didn't turn out well. And I mean, they're still developing the mission plan for going to Mars, and I think one part of that mission plan under the bioethics section would be that if you want to have kids after this mission, you want to bank your eggs and sperm, because you'll be sterile by the time you get to Mars, probably. That's the realistic outcome of a manned Mars mission. Now, in terms of giving birth, if you're able to, you're able to bypass the radioactive effects on the reproduction system, and you're able to give birth on Mars, then it's less the radiation effect and more the absence of gravity, I think, would be a concern. And they have experimented with animal models, even on station. I think I can't remember which animal they used, but they have actually had, I think, births in zero G, or simulated zero G at least, to see what the effects would be. But it's probably not an experiment you want to be a part of.
I think it was with mice, wasn't it?
I think you're right. Yeah.
But we don't seem to be progressing in that. Is that another one of those things where it's going to be on the job research, rather than there's really no way to research this on Earth and come up with definitive answers?
For radiation.
Yeah, for radiation. We'll just stay with the topic of radiation.
Yeah, I think. Once you start talking about high level of radiation and reproduction, it's always bad news. I mean, it's there's not much you can do about that. You just have to shield against it the best you can. And that's where that I forgot what the best is. The European Space Agency, they developed this a thing called AstroRad. It's basically this bulletproof type vest concept that I mentioned before.
Uh-huh.
The vest that you wear during the mission to protect all the vital organs, those susceptible organs, and that's maybe one way around it, is to actually to wear this vest the whole mission, basically, so you protect the reproductive organs.
What are we missing that's in discussion in your book that we haven't covered yet? Let's go back and focus on some of the topics that are in your book, because again, I have it on ebook. There's a lot of incredible pictures and drawings, and a lot of charts and graphs, and it's factual. It is a factual book. It's not just a, you know, airport novel kind of thing. So, you know, if you really want to know about radiation, it's a good source. But from your perspective, what are some of the highlights that you'd like to call to our attention?
All right, well, there's all sorts of ways NASA's looking at this problem. I mean, everything from therapeutic hibernation, which is something that the European Space Agency is looking at. That's basically putting people in sort of hibernated states. Also looking, I'd say there's a greater focus now on omics. For those of you not familiar with omics, it's personalized medicine, and that makes sense because, like I say, everybody reacts to radiation differently. Some people are more susceptible. Some people are very resistant. Some people don't suffer as much tissue damage. Some people do suffer a lot of tissue damage. And also, if in a worst case scenario you have a radiation storm and you get astronauts coming down with acute radiation sickness, then you may need to treat them with medication. And again, everybody has different reactions to medication. Some people are very susceptible to Tylenol, for example, just as they would be to certain radiation medications such as amifosfine. So it makes sense to integrate omics, and you'll see this is getting more and more traction every year, this concept of personalized medicine. Now, getting a bit further over the horizon, you can start talking about genetic manipulation. If you think that sounds like science fiction, then it's not, because we have what's called gene doping. Those of you who are sports fans, you'll have seen evidence of that in the Beijing Olympics in 2008. That is manipulating the genome, and we've been doing that for the last 10 years. And so rather than manipulate the genome to excel in sports, we can maybe start manipulating the genome to actually make astronauts more radiation resistant. And that's we can't do that right now, but it's maybe a possibility
in the near
future.
Is that legal in sports, or is that a violation?
No, it's legal. It's illegal, but they can't. They don't have any test to test it.
So it's not the same as blood doping, where you...
No. Okay. But it's illegal. It's still doping. Gene doping is still doping.
So what do? You try to manipulate a couple of key genes to make you perform better?
Well, things like oxygen uptake, for example. You can manipulate certain parts of the blood to actually increase oxygen uptake, that sort of thing.
Interesting. And so if they want to test you for it, how would they catch someone doing it?
Well, that's it. They can't.
The perfect crime.
I mean, if you really want to go over the horizon, you look at the movie Moon with Sam Rockwell, cloning. I mean, the Chinese cloned monkeys this year, and you can be sure as eggs are eggs, somebody somewhere is trying to clone a human. It's only a matter of time. I mean, if we can clone monkeys, then humans aren't.
They're cloning dogs for $50,000 a copy.
Well, that's right.
Or cats.
So what rights does a cloned human have?
I don't know.
Nobody's gone down that road yet.
I don't know. Should I clone Dr. Space since I'm getting older?
Maybe
we can do a crowdfunding program to raise money so the space show continues indefinitely.
That's it. We're not that far away.
Except the clone copy doesn't necessarily do the same thing as the original copy, right?
No, it doesn't. No, I mean, it's nature and nurture, right? So it depends on what sort of environment that person grows up in. But
if we stuck a clone Dr. Space in Tulsa, Tulsa today is a lot different than the 1940s and 50s. So
that's right. Yeah.
The culture and the environment would be totally, totally different.
Like I said, that's a science fiction option, is to send clones.
Pretty fascinating world that we're going to have. So if we're looking at having some economical, and I want to stress economical with you, not just technology or medical or scientific, but the mitigation strategy has to be economical. Are we at all on a close-in timeline for meaningful radiation protection for, say, humans to Mars?
Well, I think if you look at all the strategies, there's not one magic bullet that is going to solve the problem. Even if you have the speed, I mean, the speed getting there quicker rather than later is going to be a big part of that magic bullet. But there's going to be a combined number of strategies that are going to be employed to actually mitigate the radiation risk. And part of that will be shielding, part of it will be speed, part of it will be phenotyping, and part of it will be omics, for example, a personalized medicine. And so you're looking at diet, lifestyle, environment, everything about optimizing safety and performance that align with mission demands when it comes to radiation protection. So that's what you're going to see. I mean, there's no big mission. It's not a mission killer. It's just that it requires a lot of different strategies that still need to be worked on, and they are being worked on. And all those strategies need to be employed in a way to ensure crew safety. And it can be done. It's just it will just take a while.
You have Brad, and Brad is in Flagstaff, Arizona, and he says, Eric, from your vantage point, is this, if you had to identify, I'm trying to edit this on the fly, I don't want to read a long email. If you, as a professor, got a chance to create a new discipline that would advance the study of this, could you do this in one overall general discipline, and what would it be, rather than having to follow a multi-discipline curricula that might take you years?
That would probably, well, there's couple of options there. One would be bioethics. I mean, you have to have a bioethical framework for this because one of the biggest... I mean, this can all be solved in one stroke of a pen. I mean, it's called a waiver. I mean, those of you familiar with the military, you know, you sign lots and lots of waivers.
Right.
I mean, NASA could solve this just by saying, look, we're not going to have the limit of 3% increasing of cancer in a lifetime. We'll make it 6. There you go. Problem solved. Done. Don't have to worry about it anymore because they've just increased the career limit. So, but before you reach that point, there has to be some bioethical discussion in terms of, you know, what are the risks and how we define the risks and, you know, what are, you know, how might we mitigate these risks. So bioethics hasn't really received a lot of attention when it comes to, you know, manned missions to Mars, and I think it's going to require a lot more bioethical discussion in terms of, you know, how we define the risks and how we characterize the risks, especially when it comes to radiation. So bioethics, I think, is something that I'll be pushing. I mean, it's something that I'm pushing for on the curriculum here at Andrew Riddle. And in terms of the life sciences, then, like I said, there's an entire book. I've got a textbook in front of me, Space Radiation and Astronaut Safety. There's enough there for an entire semester at an undergraduate level. But I would suggest that's a pretty specialized subject, which is probably more suitable for postgraduate level discussion as opposed to undergraduate. Because at the undergraduate level, when we talk about space operations, we talk about they get a general introduction to life support, they get an introduction to like the space station, the space shuttle, that sort of thing, to actually look at one particular aspect of life sciences or life support, such as radiation. That's pretty specific.
Yeah, but space advocates, they could be developed enough and advanced enough to easily understand this book.
Oh, they could, yeah.
They should have a copy of it because it would maybe reduce a lot of their stress and anguish by having a factual base on many of these topics.
Well, I think was this question about what course would be added to a curriculum? Was that the question?
Right, that was kind of it. Could you do it in say one overall career discipline instead of following a multi-discipline career path, and not necessarily in one class, but could there be this is how I interpreted the question, could there be a new topic, a new discipline that would cover all of this under one umbrella? And
yeah, I'd probably categorize it as medical risks in spaceflight, or that'd be an appropriate subject, I think.
Here's another one for you. John is in Houston, and he says, Eric, with your reputation in the field and your expertise, have you ever had a chance to talk to anyone about life sciences and the life support issues for a SpaceX mission? Has anyone from SpaceX reached out to you, or have you ever tried to make contact with SpaceX folks?
I have. For my book, I wanted to include a few paragraphs about the day in the life of a SpaceX engineer. And we have students who work for SpaceX, so I thought I'd contact one of my students and say, look, do you mind, you know, asking a few questions about what it's like to work for SpaceX?
I can tell you what they said.
And the guy said, yeah, sure, I just need to clear it with my manager. And, of course, the next day, no.
No, they won't.
There's no way you can speak to a SpaceX engineer. There's absolutely no way. It's like dealing with the NSA or the NRO. If not worse, like the NRO is the most secretive security organization you have in the United States, and that's pretty much what SpaceX is like in trying to get information because they won't let you have information. And so I haven't been approached. I know people who work for Bigelow in life support, and they're much more open, but still, it's proprietary, so that there's a limit to what they can say. We won't get any factual information. Well, we won't get much information from SpaceX in terms of how they're going to develop their life support system for the BFR. No.
Do you even know if they have a life support department?
I usually keep a lookout on the job opportunities for SpaceX. I remember about 18 months ago they were looking for a spacesuit engineer because Elon Musk likes to have control over everything. He won't go out and buy a spacesuit from another company. He'll design it in-house, which is what he did. But I haven't seen any. I haven't seen any openings for life support engineers recently.
What about Bezos? Do you hear anything there?
No, it's all engineers. It's all like mainstream engineers to build the new Glenn.
All right, we have another note from our friend in Sweden. So Bijan says, What would you do about this problem sitting at home?
Which problem? The radiation problem.
I guess. I mean, this is exactly right. Word for word
okay.
with the email. What would you do about this problem? Question mark. Sit right. at home? Question mark.
Well, I'd ruggedize the current copper of spacecraft. By ruggedizing, I mean put a little bit more shielding on there. I would include a storm shelter, a water wall storm shelter inside, right in the center of the service module when we're talking about the Orion configuration, for example, because that's the spacecraft that we have closest to becoming operational. I would start phenotyping, talk about genetic selection of astronauts. If they have that gene that identifies radiation resistance, then I'd look for it and select astronauts who have that gene. I would look at omics, personalized medicine, when it comes to medication for pharmacological intervention. So basically, it's a multi-faceted approach. There's lots and lots of ways you deal with this, and you combine them all in one radiation mitigation strategy. So that radiation mitigation strategy is not just one magic bullet. It comprises lots and lots of strategies. And like I say, we're not there yet, but I think within 5 or 6 years, you've got a much better chance of surviving a Mars mission without coming down with radiation sickness.
And Bijan, if you're talking about the problem of being a couch potato, I would say get off your butt and start getting around and moving and walking and exercising and doing things in life that interest you other than sitting on your butt on the couch, if that's what you meant by that. I don't know if that's what you meant or not. We didn't touch or really we didn't really address microgravity, muscle issues, other issues like vision per se, and other than cataracts. But how interrelated are these issues or challenges to radiation? If we were making a flow chart and just for the fun of it, we put radiation at the top and everything then comes through radiation, like the big CEO is up at the top and you got all these arms coming into the other boxes. Could you make the case that they're all related?
Not all, but some. So, for example, we know astronauts have vision problems, and we know those are exacerbated by radiation because of the Apollo experience. We know astronauts lose bone mass, and we know that if you're exposed to higher levels of radiation, you get what is called osteoradionecrosis and osteitis. So basically, you get accelerated bone loss because of radiation. That's something that would be experienced in deep space. So we know that this radiation doesn't just affect the genetic material. It also affects other things that are happening in the body as part of the deconditioning process. And the bone one is a particularly important one because 6 months in space in low Earth orbit, you lose about 8% of your bone mass. And that equates to a 2 to 3-fold increase in fracture risk. So imagine what happens after 3 times that length of time in space. I mean, you've lost a lot more bone. You maybe lost 20% of your bone in 18 months in space. And that corresponds to a very, very high risk of fracture. And now you throw radiation into the mix, and you're accelerating that rate of bone loss. That's probably one of the most critical medical operational concerns there is the radiation effect on bone loss.
Coming up on the end of our 90 minutes, what's your next book? You always have a book in progress or two in progress. What's next?
I've slowed down now. I've retired, really, because I'm just doing expeditions.
I don't believe it. You, really and truly?
Well, no, I'm taking a year to do a book as opposed to what I was doing before. I'm doing second editions. So I'm writing the second edition of SpaceX, so that's going to come out in summer next year.
What will be new in the second edition of SpaceX?
Well, there's a lot. There's a BFR. There's the whole history of the Falcon 9, because when I published in 2013, Falcon 9 hadn't flown. It's flown 70-odd missions right now, I think. Is it 70 missions, 70-something missions?
Oh, yeah, and you got reusable on it, too.
So. Yeah, so that's a whole appendix right there. Then there's the whole retro propulsion, the landing of the first stage, all that has to go in, the ITS, the Raptor, the Super Draco, all that has to go in.
So it'll be a whole new book for the most part.
It's about, I think I worked it out, something like 40% new material, yeah.
When is it out?
It'll be published in summer next year.
Well, that'll be an interesting space show for sure. What's before then? Do we have to wait a year?
No, like I say, my bucket list was to write a bookshelf of books, and on my bookshelf at home, it's 30 books, and with SpaceX, it'll be 30, so that's it. So I'm just going to do, I'll just do second editions after that, I think.
You're still teaching?
Yeah. So we're doing, teach commercial space operations, teach introduction to space flight, life support systems, space station, and then just putting together a new program on the space shuttle, which is going to be taught for the first time next semester.
But no online teaching where listeners could take a class of yours?
Oh, no, I do. I teach for integratedspaceflight.com, and I do Open University. I teach life support system. I also teach EVA 101 on that, and that's you can find that out. That's a university-accredited course with three continuing education units, so it's actually an approved university course that you have to do that through Integrated Spaceflight. And
so if we go to integratedspaceflight.com, we can find these classes if people are interested in taking them with you.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
So it's an online course. Part of it, some of them are just online. Some of them have an online component and a practical component. So for the EVA 101, I teach the theoretical component, and then I'm actually involved in the practical component, which is the spacesuit testing.
What should we have talked about regarding radiation, your book, and more that we have not talked about or forgotten or that you would like to make sure we know about?
Well, no, just the damage, really, because that's usually glossed over in most discussions about radiation in deep space. And, you know, all these magic solutions that that seem to materialize at will, and that there is no one solution, there's no magic bullet, but just to know that there are lots of there's a lot of work going on to try and resolve this problem. ESA with the Astrorad, for example, the bulletproof vest, I think is one of the most promising. That's, you know, actually might be flight tested, I think, soon, from what I remember. Also the omics. And just remember that there's no magic bullet. There's a lot of strategies that have to be employed to mitigate radiation risk in space, because it is one of the biggest hazards out there.
Okay, Eric, listen, I'll look forward to hearing back from you when you have more news for us. I just got a final note in, and this is Robert, and Robert is in Oklahoma City. And he says, can you do a quick update on Vasimir? Do you know any progress, what's happening with it?
The last I heard, they're planning the 100-hour test next month, and the NASA managers, because Vasimir, or Ad Astra, I should say, the company, right, they have a Space Act agreement with NASA to fly a scaled-down version of Vasimir on the space station in 2020 to do what's called a technology test and demonstration, similar to the BEAM, which is the bigger expandable activity module, which was flown on CRS Flight 9 in April 2016. And they would fly this scaled-down Vasimir to do reboost, because, as you know, the station loses just over a mile of altitude every month. So about two or three times a year they have to do reboost operations. Right now they have to use the fuel in the Progress. That's a big weight penalty. And the thing with Vasimir, it still uses fuel, but the weight is a lot less. And so they would fly that on the truss for 2 years, and in the meantime they would try and scale it up to a man-rated version. But to do that, they need to have a lot more energy. So if that 100-hour test goes well, then they get the green flag to actually fly the test and technology demonstrator on ISS in 2020. That's as much as I know. And I'm hoping to go and see that test.
Okay. Great. Eric, thanks for being with us. We really appreciate hearing from you again.
Well, thanks again, David. Appreciate it.
Okay. And listeners, that's it. So we appreciate those of you who sent in email conversations with us today, and always thank Eric for being with us. Look at all of our programs planned for this week, and open lines on Sunday. Everybody have a great week. Keep looking up. Goodbye from Eric, David, and the Space Show.